Your SteveJonesShow.com audio is coming up next. Audio and podcast of The Steve Jones Show, a service of Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street, Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, Routes 11 and 15, Hummel's Wharf.
Sports talk where your voice counts. This is The Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now, from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Welcome here to Sunbury Motors Studio. 4th Street in Sunbury, Sunbury Motors Kia, Routes 11 to 15, Hummel's Wharf. It's great to see the Sunbury Motors crew out in full force yesterday. Also, Hilsers General Store sponsoring our hotline at 1-800-795-9565, powered by Hilsers General Store. Go to www.hilsersstore.com. We're joined by my good friend Bob Buhner to talk about the events of today. First of all, Bob, welcome. It is great to have you back on the show.
Done teaching so I can appear more periodically than I have because my pedagogical duties are concluded at Westminster College.
Your what?
Well, teaching duties.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for putting it down to my level so I can understand.
Yes. Well, when you're a professor, you must use big words.
Ah, that explains it.
And, of course, Professor Jones understands what I'm talking about.
If you could use as many monosyllabic words as possible, Bob, that would be great to help out some members of the show.
I know that word.
I say amen. Well, Steve and Kevin,
this lawsuit that the Judge Yvette Kane, the antitrust suit that was tossed, we talked about it when it was filed back in January. You talked about the pluses and the minuses, the merits and the areas where it could get in trouble. I sense from you then you didn't think it had a lot of chance for success. Were you surprised it was tossed as quickly as it was?
I have to say that I was surprised that it was dismissed. And the judge in the order that she signs along with at the end of the decision said the complaint was dismissed. Normally, judges will put in something along the lines of an addendum that says it's dismissed. However, the plaintiffs are free to file an amended complaint, which could address any deficiencies in the original complaint. And that was not done. This is an outright dismissal. And the judge used some really colorful language in her decision. It totals about 20 pages. She referred to the complaint filed by Governor Corbett as a Hail Mary, right, and said that basically he failed to advance the ball.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I thought that was a bit unusual for a judge to resort to those kinds of phrases in her decision, but I think she was trying to convey the point rather clearly that this action by Governor Corbett in filing an antitrust lawsuit failed to meet the standards set forth for those kinds of activities, at least here in what is known as the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the states of Delaware, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and oddly enough, the Virgin Islands. She applied the standard in the Third Circuit. And here's what's really interesting about this. In her decision, she talks about a case out of the Seventh Circuit, which could have resulted in a different result in her decision than the one here in Pennsylvania. So what that tells me is whenever there is a split of law among the circuit courts of appeal, which are the courts one rung below the U.S. Supreme Court,
right,
that's when the U.S. Supreme Court gets involved to resolve where one part of the country is going one way and another part of the country in the legal system is going another way.
Bob, is there a different standard applied when it's an antitrust suit versus a lawsuit, for example, that the five parties put together against the NCAA that was announced last week?
It was a huge difference, and it's very significant. This decision by Judge Kane today will have, in my opinion, absolutely no bearing on several outstanding other lawsuits. The first, there's the one that was filed by State Senator Corman and the Treasurer McCord of the Commonwealth regarding that law that was passed in Pennsylvania requiring the $60 million fund that the NCAA has set up that Penn State must pay. There's a lawsuit about that. And then the NCAA has countersued in that to declare the law null and void. And then we've got the Paterno family, some trustees as in their individual capacity, other football players in the Paterno era, and even some college professors. This decision will have no impact on any of that.
Okay, let's talk about the standard. What is the standard that, for the most part, needs to be applied in an antitrust suit moving forward versus a standard in your, quote, run-of-the-mill lawsuit moving forward that does not have antitrust implications, thus does not have the implications of having awards trebled?
Right. The big thing that were antitrust laws, and we've had antitrust laws in the U.S. for well over 100 years. It was called the Sherman Act, and then there's another act after that. They've been around for a long time. The NCAA was involved in a major case that we talked about a while ago where the universities of Oklahoma and Texas sued the NCAA because the NCAA had a limit on the number of times a school could appear on a national television broadcast.
In fact, that was Oklahoma and Georgia.
Oklahoma and Georgia. And the result of that was the court said that is definitely commercial activity that is being implicated by this decision by the NCAA, and that these universities are negatively impacted by these rules economically. And so that case stands for the proposition that in certain instances, the NCAA can engage in anti-competitive commercial activity and thus bring them into the realm or into the court system subject to the Sherman Antitrust Act. The judge said today in her decision that there is no implication of commercial activity involved in Governor Corbett's lawsuit. At best, it is speculative. There are no facts that have come to light that show that the direct result of the NCAA action is resulting in anti-competitive activities detrimental to Penn State or, in the larger context, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
Now, the primary statutes in antitrust law are the Sherman Act, which you mentioned. That goes back to 1890. The other one is the Clayton Act of 1914. Those are the two primary ones that you look at.
Right. And the Clayton Act allows for a party who is alleging harm to come in and get an injunction to stop the anti-competitive behavior. And in this case, the court said, there's no need to even consider an injunction because there's no anti-competitive behavior. And what what Judge Kane talked about was, I simply don't have any facts in front of me on the documents you, Governor Corbett, have filed to show anything that would put it into any anti-competitive context. And therefore, your complaint fails. And she goes in to talk about, I'm not here to discuss the wisdom or lack thereof of President Erickson's accepting the sanctions under the threat of the death penalty. I'm not here to decide any of these other things. The only thing I'm going to do is decide whether this is involving the Sherman antitrust law. And since I've determined it, I don't have to address all this other stuff, even whether Governor Corbett has the standing to bring the lawsuit himself. And she relies on case law here in the Pennsylvania, New Jersey area, and there was the case that she cites is a case involving a ball who and then transferred to another school and wanted to, but it still had a year of eligibility and wanted to compete for that school in volleyball, and this Third Circuit Court of Appeals said those kinds of things about scholarships and eligibility requirements, that's not antitrust matter. and that is the law of the Third Circuit of the United States. And she pointed out there was a case in the Seventh Circuit where it was a similar kind of a situation involving scholarships, and the Seventh Circuit went the other way. And why right. I think this is important is, as I said, when you have these divergent opinions from the circuits, that's when the U.S. Supreme Court likes to resolve and clarify the law. So, point is, I have a feeling that Governor Corbett will appeal this decision.
Right.
And because of that, and knowing that the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, in which is this region, will affirm its the decision most likely, but then citing the conflict of laws among the United States, go to the U.S. Supreme Court.
In the appeals process, okay, yes. You just mentioned this is the level below the Supreme Court.
Right.
Is in the appeals process actually to go to a Supreme Court justice, or what is the next step if you wish to appeal?
The next step would be to appeal to the Third Circuit, which is, I think, headquartered in Philadelphia.
It is.
One of my law school classmates who's from Shamokin, his name's Tom Vanasky, and Judge Vanasky was an All-American football player at Lycoming, by the way. He sits on the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. So if there's ever an expert on the court that would be inclined to be assigned the case, it just might be Judge Vanasky. So we might have some real local flavor, but I think he's a Notre Dame fan, as I recall from my law school days. But the Third Circuit right. Court of Appeals, and this is not a quick process, by the way.
No.
One of the things that I think the judge could be criticized for as a potential, Steve and Kevin, is that she did not permit any what we call discovery, depositions, producing documents. And then she criticized Corbett's complaint, saying, you're making all these bald assertions without any real factual basis. And I think the comeback to that is, well, we didn't get a chance to, Judge, because you wouldn't allow us to go engage in discovery, so we had to set forth the facts that we knew them, but we don't know everything. And she even
this lawsuit, because I was on the road doing basketball at the time, so you pick it up as you go, and also you had helped me tremendously early on, letting me know what they were attempting to do with this. I recall what part of this antitrust suit was about, a section of it was harm done to the economic viability of the State College area by what has happened through the sanctions. And that really was never brought out in this, because the dismissal happened actually in relative terms quickly.
Yes, and so how can you prove something that's basically speculation at this point, because, you know, we're just in year number one at best in this whole situation. And so I think there's room to criticize the judge and say, Judge, maybe you ought to allow the parties to at least engage in some fact-finding and then come back and amend their complaint with real facts, or if they can't justify it, you know, it gets tossed.
Well, let's then take it from the other side now. The fact that she did dismiss it quickly then allows a quicker process in the appeal and moves it up the ladder, actually. I mean, can you look at it that way?
You can, and I think that there's something to be said for that. I mean, she really moved with incredible speed for the judiciary, I have to say. 3 weeks is a blink of the eye when it comes to deciding such an important matter, and I think she did so to give at least one sense of finality at this stage of the process to both parties so they can then move on. Because what you'd hate to have happen at the end of is that this case ends up 5 years from now in front of the Supreme Court, and they may make a decision, but it's all moot at that point in time.
Yeah, this ends up being a 6-year sanction. There are 5 more years to go, really, on the sanctions to begin with. And, you know, again, I've tried to explain to people repeatedly, you hear 4 years of probation. This is not a 4-year sanction. It is 6. There's 1 down, 5 to go. That is the severity and the length that's put in play. So the longer this plays out, you're right, it then warps into irrelevancy.
Yeah, well, and the court's going to say, you know, down the road, well, isn't, you know, gentlemen and lady lawyers that are involved in this, isn't this case over and done with? Because isn't, aren't the 6 years up? And what do you want us to do about it now? You know, do you want us to unring the bell that's been rung? So I think the fact that she did people a favor by, and I will say this: when you I've read all 20 pages of her decision, it's a pretty well reasoned decision.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That obviously consumed her for the last 3 weeks and her law clerks and research staff. And as I said, there were some corny football analogies with Hail Mary and advancing the ball. And she also talked about how widely debated in the public arena the sanctions, the decisions, all the swirling controversies that are going on involving this are of actually no consequence to her. But she kind of pointed out she was aware of them. So.
One final question, Bob, sure, before I let you go, and that is, we know that the suit was filed by the five groups against the NCAA. That is not an antitrust case.
Right.
If that moves forward, okay, and they got, you know me, I don't usually delve into speculation, because it's, I usually find it worthless, but I'm gonna break that rule here for a moment because I think people are looking for an answer here.
Mm-hmm.
If that case is allowed to move forward, and if in Philadelphia they say, okay, well, we see some merit here, the lawsuit that the five filed, if in discovery there are certain interesting things that come up in discovery, can they then share with the group that is in the antitrust case of what they've found out in discovery?
Absolutely. Unless somehow the NCAA would try and get what's known as a protective order, which are really suspect by judges. They don't like to grant them, saying, you know, this is proprietary information, and therefore you can give it to the five parties in the Paterno family, coaches are involved, etc. They could try and seal that, but I don't think that'll happen. So, yes, there could be definite information sharing, which then could, in one sense, significantly revive the Corbett lawsuit. Because one of the criticisms that Judge Kane had is that there was a requirement that you be factually specific in making these allegations, and there were just too many generalities or speculative matters in the complaint that the governor filed, without an underlying factual basis. And she said you must plead these matters with rather specific particularity, and you have failed to do so. So I'm left to guess and speculate. I'm not going to do that. But if it comes out, they can fill, the Corbett's team can fill in the blanks.
Should be pointed out, though, the road to that is a very, very long, long road. I mean, that my question was pure speculation.
Mm-hmm.
Figured I'd get it out there so Bob can answer it for us in a legal sense, but the road to that is going to take years. It's not going. It's interesting. She made her decision relatively quick in the judicial system. Everything else is going to take a long, long time. I don't think people have to understand that.
I would say this, that if the matter gets appealed by Corbett's team to the Third Circuit, and I have every reason to believe that it might, that is like a year-long process at a minimum. Here's the other part of this that was not addressed. The NCAA, as the winning party in a motion to dismiss, can probably go back to Judge Kane and say, Judge, we had to come to Pennsylvania to defend an absolutely worthless lawsuit filed against us, and we have incurred X number of dollars, probably be in seven figures, of expenses like this meritless suit, and Judge, would you please order Governor Corbett and the Commonwealth to pay our costs and fees? That is normally what happens. In the federal system, there's a rule of loser pays winner's costs and expenses. And that will just be the subject of innumerable political discussions as the next year evolves. And
Bob, my friend, always a great pleasure. Thanks for filling in as many blanks as possible, because you know, in terms of my questions when it comes to the law, there are many blanks that have to be filled in.
There you go, my friend.
Thank you, Bob. Appreciate it, my bud.
Anytime, Steve. Take care, Kevin.
Thanks a lot, Bob. Appreciate it.
Bye.
And one quick chorus of Buhner.
Buhner. Buhner time.
He's the best. He really is. All right.
You know, one thing that you guys delved into that I thought was really important is if this does continue on, the length of time is almost going to make it pointless.
Well, and that's part of the game that's being played here. I mean, the NCAA will do whatever it can to draw this out further and further and further. So it does warp into irrelevancy as time goes. There's already 1 year down and five to go. Well, they'll go through this season, and there'll be nothing done on any front about anything, which we know. I think that's a safe assumption to make, which means that'll be two down and four to go. You know, and it just, the process takes a long time. Wick Sollers was on Bob Costas' show last week. He says, look, this is a long, long road. Well, it is a long, long road. Now, in the end, though, it may not be able to do anything about the current situation, but maybe if they do win, it actually makes the situation down the road better, either for individuals or actually for other people that the NCAA go after. How about that?
Yeah, that's exactly what I think the summary of it is at this point.
Yeah. So, but I thought, to me, the most important question in that was actually the one I asked about sharing. You know, if the Paterno suit were to go through, and that's no guarantee, if the Paterno suit were to go through, and say the judge keeps it moving, and they are allowed to eventually get to the discovery area, which means then there are people that have to be interviewed, that have to actually sit down and answer questions. Well, if they find out some things during the answers, say they do, they are then allowed to share that information with those who filed the antitrust suit. Now, this is all what if, what if, what if, what if, what if. But what the heck, it's a talk show. It's all about what if.
That's the fun of it.
News is next on News Radio 1070 WKOK.
Quality pre-owned vehicle? Well, get them before they go to auction at Sunbury Motors. Go to sunburymotors.com and click on pre-auction blowout. Like a 2008 Honda Fit HB Mansport. Call for our lowest price promise, 888-536-8017. 2010 Chevy Equinox four-wheel drive LT, $13,985. 2010 Ford Focus, reliable and affordable, just $13,997. 2011 Ford Escape four-wheel drive XLT, just $18,877. 2010 Ford Roush Mustang 427R, a must-see, $33,995. And 2009 GMC Canyon Crew Cab. Call for a price, 888-536-8017. These deals won't last, so hurry in. All come with a Carfax report and our lowest price promise. Pre-auction blowout, 24/7 at sunburymotors.com, at the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and at our dealership, Routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sunbury Motors, a tradition of trust since 1915.
This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motor Studio, here's Steve Jones.
You know, it is amazing. You are making the big show now.
I thought this was the big show.
Oh, yeah, well, it's kind of separate. To be on the Lawrence show, man.
I'm just the one that presses the buttons.
You're up there with Reichle.
I'm just pressing the buttons and answering the phones.
He used you and Reichle in the same sentence. I find that amazing.
You may have to tune in tomorrow to find out more.
I know I'm going to. I'm going to sit down here in the Sunbury Motor Studio, tune in and find out exactly how raucous you are.
Raucous. That's my favorite word.
I mean, this is a guy earlier in the week trying to trade Dominic Brown.
I'm not going to go into that again. I have a question, since you've talked baseball. By the way, top of the eighth, Orioles lead the Astros 3-1.
Yeah, America is riveted on that. I've actually got one on – I want to get to this story, actually, before we get to your question.
All right, go ahead then. Sorry.
Murray Chass, you know one of my primary complaints about how sports are viewed and covered these days is that, for the most part, individuals' view of history is last week's tweet.
Right.
When it's far deeper than that. And Murray Chass wrote this article today. And, of course, we've had Murray on the show. He's been around the block many, many times. I will read you the article. If Major League Baseball players didn't learn a vitally valuable lesson from the Kirk Radomski episode of the steroids wars, they should finally learn from the Tony Bosch chapter. If you're going to cheat, beware the guys who make it possible to cheat. Know that in the end, those enablers will turn on them to save their skin and sell out the players who paid them to play the illegal steroids game. No honor among thieves, as the old saying goes. No honor among steroid salesmen and their buyers. Who ratted on Roger Clemens, his former trainer and supplier, not to mention injector Brian McNamee? Where would Major League Baseball steroids initiative be without Radomski or Bosch? It would be in need of heavy daily doses of steroids. That's where. One key witness MLB or the government never got was Barry Bonds' former trainer Greg Anderson. He went to jail a couple of times because he refused to testify. Baseball has uncovered steroids cheats through its testing programs, but those cheats have been a fraction of the players nabbed by using banned performance-enhancing substances, steroids, human growth hormone, testosterone, amphetamines. MLB has done very little of its own original work to uncover the cheaters. Without Radomski, a clubhouse attendant turned steroid salesman, there would never have been the Mitchell Report. Without Bosch, operator of a now-closed South Florida anti-aging clinic, there would be no current investigation involving allegations of use of banned substances by Alex Rodriguez, Ryan Braun, Melky Cabrera, Nelson Cruz, and who knows how many others. Murray Chass continues. Once Bosch reportedly agreed to give MLB names of his alleged baseball clients, the baseball world, fueled by the news media, always hungry for a hot steroid story, remember, don't let the facts get in the way of a good story, erupted in an orgy of speculation. I think ESPN.com was the best or most incendiary or most outrageous. I guess the sports network felt it had a right to claim that status because its reporters were the first with the story on Tuesday. However, as we have learned over and over, being first doesn't automatically make a news outlet right. Jason Stark, biggest sports bust ever, said the headline by the veteran reporter Jason Stark, by the way, whom we have, by the way, personal respect for. He's been on this show a couple different times. We could be on the verge of the biggest drug bust in sports history, the report said. On the website the next day, ESPN.com, under the triple byline of T.J. Quinn, Pedro Gomez, and Mike Fish, reported Major League Baseball will seek to suspend about 20 players connected to the Miami area clinic at the heart of an ongoing performance-enhancing drug scandal, including Alex Rodriguez and Ryan Braun, possibly within the next few weeks. Outside the Lines has learned, if the suspensions are upheld, the performance-enhancing drug scandal will be the largest in American sports history. Murray Chass writes, I respect all four reporters who wrote those misguided words in both reports, but where is their knowledge of baseball history? And I'm not talking about ancient history. Granted, this is not war or VORP, but have they ever heard of the Pittsburgh drug trials of 1985 and the cocaine scandal, to use a popular and overused journalistic word, that prompted then-Commissioner Peter Eubroth to discipline 21 players, suspending 11 of them and meting out lesser penalties to 10 others? The ESPN reporters did not offer any context by mentioning 1985. The articles didn't even mention the pirate Parrott, who served as the players' clubhouse cocaine conduit, and their editors, whom I have long found unworthy of editing a major sports webpage. They provide no help, no support to the reporters, and did nothing to illuminate the context for ESPN readers. Murray Chass continues, ESPN has banged away at Rodriguez and Braun because they are the biggest names in the story. But was Dave Parker a big name in 1985? Keith Hernandez, his quote, cocaine is the devil on earth. Joaquin Andujar, Dusty Baker, Tim Raines, Lonnie Smith, Gary Matthews, or Vida Blue. Were any of these names worthy enough to be raised in connection with the Bosch story? Okay, if not, what about Willie Mays, Willie Stargell, and Bill Madlock? They weren't disciplined, but Parker and Dale Barra testified that they got amphetamines from Willie Stargell and Bill Madlock when they played for the Pittsburgh Pirates. John Milner testified that Mays had, quote, red juice, the liquid equivalent of greenies or amphetamines, in his San Francisco locker. Readers or viewers will find no reference to any of this in ESPN's exclusive report on Bosch, the latest crook to turn on his co-conspirators. No one has quoted Bosch about his decision to help MLB catch the cheaters, but he apparently decided to turn on them to get MLB off his back and drop its lawsuit against him. His cooperation with baseball may also make law enforcement authorities less likely to pursue prosecution against him. No one has said that he has been offered such a deal, but that's what delivered Radomski to MLB for the Mitchell Report. He was assured that he would not be prosecuted if he cooperated with Major League Baseball, so he did. His assistance made the December 2007 Mitchell Report possible. Without information from Radomski, the former United States Senator and Senate Majority Leader had mostly old newspaper articles with which to fill his report. Instead, he crammed it with 51 names, the most prominent of which, Roger Clemens, Andy Pettit, Jason Giambi, Mo Vaughn, Miguel Tejada, Paul LaDuca, Eric Gagne, and Kevin Brown. Commissioner Bud Selig disciplined none of the Radomski clients cited by Mitchell, which may provide a basis for appeals of any suspensions Selig may levy on any of the Bosch clients. In the context of the ESPN reports, if there are suspensions and players appeal them and win, I guess I would that would mean that the accused and the union were the ones that foiled the biggest bust in sports history. Murray Chass. Interesting. And I pointed this out for a long time. I don't understand the lack of knowledge of history. I don't understand it. I don't understand the short memories where everything is the biggest, the best ever. It's now. I mean, it's now. I mean, I know people have asked me, you know, they see LeBron. LeBron is a great player. He's the best player right now in basketball. No question. But if I had to pick one player in the history of basketball to start my franchise, I'd pick Bill Russell. Why? I saw both of them play. I'd pick Russell. And score like LeBron. But he's just my personal preference as to how I'd start my franchise. Everything's always the biggest scandal now, the biggest bust ever, the biggest. That's not true. Today isn't the biggest, best, brightest, awesome, most incredible. It's, you know, maybe at some moment it is, but not, you know. We just saw the fastest Indianapolis 500 ever. Right? That's historical fact. Was it the best finish ever? No. You had a question about all this.
Well, I'll get to that in a minute. I have Bill Purdy waiting for you on line one.
Oh, okay. Hi, Bill. How are you?
I'm good. How are you today?
Hey, it's great to be with you again. Thanks for everything yesterday. First class event.
Well, yeah, I just wanted to call in and thank you and Kevin and the folks at Sunbury Broadcasting for coming out and supporting everything for the YMCA. I think, you know, it does a great job for the kids of the Valley, and it helps support those kids and keep them into sports and keep them into activities, and kind of follows up on some of the things you were just talking about, trying to help the kids with good things and get the bad stuff out of the news.
There's no question about that. And see, what's great about what we saw yesterday was how the people of the community come together. I guess it was a record number of foursomes involved. And when there's a record number of foursomes involved, that means more money to help out the kids.
Yeah, that's right. It's great. And, you know, obviously there's a lot of volunteers that are behind the scenes, and the folks that give up their time, that could be out doing something else, and they come and volunteer and help, and the work from the people at the Y themselves, and it's just a great event.
Yeah, it is a great event. It's the 22nd annual. We're looking forward to the 23rd. What is it about this that made you along the way, Bill? Because there have been other times that you've given donations to other entities out there. What made the Y the perfect choice for the Purdy tournament?
Well, you have to understand the history of it a little bit, the way that our father was involved in the community.
Right.
And originally, when he had passed away, the folks that call themselves the Friends of Truman Purdy at the tournament had come and asked if we would support the local community hospital.
Yes.
So we used the tournament to do that. And then when the community hospital became part of a public entity, we revamped and we looked at the YMCA, which was another community project that Dad was heavily involved with, and we thought that was a great place to have the money go to and to do some good things for the kids of the community.
Because of circumstances, we went from May 8th to June 5th. What are some of the initial thoughts on what is going to be a date for this? Do you still look at that first week of May, or did you really like the way things turned out in the first week of June?
Well, we liked the way it turned out. It was a beautiful day where everybody had a great time. What we've always looked at is historically we've been the first tournament of the year, which
right.
is something people look forward to. So I'm sure the folks at the Y and the other people involved with the golf committee will look at that, and we'll have some discussions and see how the lineup is at the country club where we hold the event. And I would think initially we'd think to keep the first event out of the chute, but I'm sure they'll have some discussions about it.
Well, Bill, we had an absolutely great time. We can't thank the Purdy's enough. We can't thank the golf course enough, Susquehanna Valley Country Club, the volunteers enough. And again, we apologize for what Kevin did in the sixth hole yesterday.
The fifth hole, listen, I'm telling you right now, between the fourth and fifth hole, the railing is fine. They didn't have to paint it. It's fine.
And he didn't hurt any of the wildlife in the creek either.
That's right. No one got hurt around in my entire round.
So
yes, those are certainly
point.
Standards I'd like to complete my round with.
Yeah. I just wanted to add also is maybe put a little promo in here for another tournament.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, there's tournaments every week, and there's a lot of people that work hard in the community to raise some money, and there's a new tournament this year which you folks are familiar with, which is the Resolute Wrestling Phil Lockoff Tournament, which is another tournament that will benefit the youth of the Valley. So they're gonna get their tournament started, and obviously any support people can give, and with that wrestling program and with what those folks do in the school district in the community, it's another worthwhile program to support.
Well, it's our pleasure to support that one as well. Bill, thank you so much for everything and for calling in. We appreciate that a lot.
All right. Thanks for all you guys do.
Bill Purdy. Boy, what a great time we had yesterday at the Purdy Memorial Golf Tournament. And once again, they did repair the railing overnight.
Well, I have two things for you. I'll get to my question a little bit later, but I did have something I wanted to share with you since we're talking about coverage of sports. Yesterday, it was the Mariners and White Sox. They were in the 14th inning. 14th inning. and it was 5-1 White Sox with the Mariners at the plate. Here are the two calls.
The grand slam. Yeah,
bases loaded, two strikes, two outs, and it's Kyle Seager at the plate. Here's KIRO and the Seattle Mariners radio network call of it.
Kyle swings, drives it right field. Could this be happening? Rios looks up. It's gone! Kyle Seager, that just happened.
All right, that was the KIRO version of it. And by the way, the Sox went on to win it in extra innings after all that.
7-5.
Here's the funny one. This is WGN-TV, obviously on the White Sox side of it.
Hawk Harrelson?
Sounds a little bit different.
And that ball hit deep into right center field. And we've got a 5-5 tie.
That's Hawk Harrelson, except, you know, the funny part, if you see the home run, there's a guy in right field.
Yes.
He doesn't see the little kid in the aisle, and he runs him trying to get the ball.
Who, by the way, has a baseball in his hand as well.
His hand.
Did you notice that?
Yeah, he did.
But, yeah, the poor kid was in the wrong spot. But I just thought that was really interesting. It was a very different call on the White Sox television network.
That's Hawk Harrelson. Okay, he makes there's no pretense there. He doesn't. He doesn't fake that he doesn't want the White Sox to win.
And it's 5-5.
It's almost like you see him throwing the program down. We'll wrap it up in a moment on News Radio 1070 WKOK. All right, we've done things in such a way today with interviews with Bob Buehner, Steve Samsel, Bill Purdy being on as well. We've done things in such a way which have kept Kevin's comments to a minimum. Unfortunately, I didn't drain enough time. He's not done yet.
Well, I did have one more. I know you're going to talk more about this tomorrow.
We're out of time.
Oh, no. See, that's the nice thing of having control. I know exactly how much time. I know tomorrow.
We're all hostages.
I know tomorrow you're going to be discussing this more, but there's Major League Baseball teams, including the Astros, are going to be coming out tonight and trying to look toward the future, like, what, 4 or 5 years down the road? What do teams look for in the Major League Baseball draft? Whereas in the NFL draft, they look for instant impact players. You don't look for that in the Major League Baseball draft.
Certain players you do. I think whomever drafts Mark Appel, and that might be the Chicago Cubs, they're looking for him to be in the rotation maybe as early as next year. I mean, Appel is a developed, almost cable-ready guy. He is very close to being there. If you draft a high school player, you are looking at 3 to 4 years of development to get them out there. If you're drafting a college guy, you're probably looking at a 3-year window. So you're looking at, if it's a high school guy, probably 5. If you're looking at a college guy, you're probably looking at 3.
Now, the Astros are first up. Who do you think they're going to take?
Jonathan Gray of Oklahoma.
Phillies, I think, are like 15 or 16. Who do they take?
Well, at that point, who knows?
Come on. There's everybody on MLB.com has a draft board already written up.
Oh, God. I think that Jonathan Gray will go first tonight, okay?
Where do they look? Let me ask you that.
Well, let's look at the – I guess you have to look at the organization. I suppose you've got to look at where you want to go in the organization.
Series would be good.
Yeah, but that's it's hard. The Major League Baseball draft is a totally different deal, okay? And so I think when you get down to like the 15th spot, maybe you're looking at probably a guy that's a right-handed pitcher. Let's go with, I don't know, Chris Anderson.